automating everything. It might be a bad idea. Seriously, that's what we're talking about today on the Datanauts podcast. I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. My co-host just hit a walk-off home run in his own personal Quidditch chess baseball mashup he plays on his highly modified Atari 2600. He's Chris Wall, and you can find him at Chris Wall all over Twitter. Joining the Datanauts today for a reality-tinged viewpoint of automation is Adam Jacob. Adam, welcome to the show, and please introduce yourself to the Datanauts audience.
Hi, I'm the CTO at Chef. And I co-founded the company, and I wrote Chef in the first place, and I wrote a thing called Habitat. And all that's really true, but mostly what I am is a systems administrator, and I have been since I was 16 or 17, and I'm 40-ish now. So it's been a while. But yeah, mostly what I do is I help people think about how to automate stuff, and then I build tools to make that easier.
At Chef, if you go over to the website, you guys have a big idea of infrastructure as code, which, you know, if I'm honest, at first blush, it sounds a little silly because infrastructure isn't code, right? It's the stuff that you run code on. What do you mean by infrastructure as code?
Yeah. What we mean by infrastructure as code is obviously there's infrastructure, metal, right? Or whatever it is, switches and routers and cables. So then when we think about how we manage that infrastructure, historically, and by historically, I mean, let's call it everything prior to EC2, we managed that stuff mainly by hand, right? We had fleets of systems administrators, we had network people, and we managed that infrastructure. And then over the top of that infrastructure that we would manage usually by hand or with some scripts or whatever, we would then roll an application on top of. And the application was obviously code, right? It was something we wrote that talked to customers, but we didn't manage our infrastructure that way. We managed our infrastructure as this sort of bespoke one-off physical thing. So infrastructure as code is about thinking about how it is that we can express what we want in infrastructure, and we can express it as code, which then lets us manage the infrastructure the same way we manage our applications, right? We can think about our infrastructure as a component in a pipeline, as piece of delivery, as the piece of the application that it sort of always was, right? And yeah, it can mean and does mean like managing the metal. It also means, you know, setting up the operating system. It can mean putting down configuration. It can mean actually installing and deploying applications. All that stuff sort of counts as infrastructure as code.
I always have the vision when I hear infrastructure as code is like when Neo starts to see the green code pieces for the walls and everything at the end of the Matrix.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm hoping at some point that's what happens. We get goggles or something and just all of a sudden we can see the code. But
that'd be pretty sweet.
It's definitely something that would be interesting, kind of a futuristic sort of piece. But I'm thinking, all right, automation, it gets this rap that it's all about making things faster. You know, we got to automate because it's about saving time and being quicker and faster and better. And I think that's sort of obvious, but I feel like you've got maybe some other ideas as to what the benefit really can be with automation beyond just I can make a really horrible thing go even faster.
Yeah, well, I mean, fast is an interesting problem, right? So a great example is if you bought a Lamborghini, Lamborghinis go really fast, right? But if the only place you could drive it was on a street that was completely walled in, that would not be super useful, right? Like you could go very fast until you either hit the wall or stopped, right? It's not just about speed. It's not just about saving time. Although like that's an obvious upside of a lot of automation is that it saves you time or it, in general, sort of the system overall gets faster. Mostly, I think what automation is about is changing the way that human beings can think about their problems. If I automate a problem for you and that problem basically can disappear from your day-to-day life, then I've freed you up to think about newer, bigger problems. And so you see this sort of evolution over time. You know, forget about computer automation, just think about automation in general. Like when we automate something, what tends to happen isn't that all those people who used to do that thing go home and like they're completely destroyed, especially because usually what happens is the market shifts and we open up some new capability we didn't have before, which then causes demand to rise and then it sort of changes the way that we work. So the number one thing about automation, while it does save time, is that it's about changing and aiding the way that human beings do their work so that that work can then change to be something else. And that may be something interesting, or it's usually hopefully something interesting that builds on top of the thing that you automated.
We've been talking a lot about the metal in our data center. At least I think that's what most of us think of because we're used to having servers and storage and networking that we care about. But really a lot of that has shifted to public cloud. And so what does that mean for automation? How have things in the automation world changed as we move workloads into the cloud?
Yeah. So what I said just a second ago, that automation is about helping human beings do the work they need to do. Historically, what that meant for automation was, once I have like a Pixie boot service that puts the operating system on the machine, then I will run some configuration management that like turns that thing into whatever it's supposed to be. The first step of doing that in the public cloud was thinking about, okay, well, how do I instantiate that machine now that it's behind an API instead of a physical thing that someone slots into a rack and turns on and puts on a network? And then once it's on that network, it Pixie boots and then it gets the operating system. Instead, it's now about, how do I manage this API endpoint? How do I manage all of the different API calls I need to make in order to have the system that I need to exist so that I could then manage it? There's sort of a co-evolution between the public cloud APIs and the things that you can do in the public cloud that you can't really do in the traditional data center. At least you can't do them very well. And configuration management. If you look at how automation has moved, we evolved our tooling to better deal with things like ephemeral hosts, right? So systems come up and they come down, which means that their life cycle is different. So it used to be that you would think about, you know, like I used to run an ad network and we had 40 different ad servers, and you would just give them a number 1 through 40. And if one died, you would replace it. But you would talk about it as, oh, I have to build a new ads 39, you know, and you wouldn't do that now. And that has implications sort of all the way through the stack. The way you think about the automation is different. The interface is different. All that stuff changes. So you get this commingling of the public APIs that you need to use to get the infrastructure. And then the automation has to evolve to deal with both those APIs and the impacts they have on the kind of infrastructure we build.
Now, you mentioned public APIs heavily, and there's a lot of tooling that's getting built out there based on those public APIs. I mean, does that frighten you a lot to have a tool that's relying on public APIs when, in theory, Amazon or fill in the blank with the cloud provider could change those APIs, and now you've got tooling that isn't working anymore and needs a lot of updating to keep up?
If I go back to what we would do, you know, the moral equivalent of I changed my API was HP puts out new hardware that no longer supports the same ILO interface it used to, right? You know, that upgrade cycle is different, but the upgrade's the same. The bright side is that now that upgrade's in software. So the difference is I don't have to go negotiate with a hardware vendor or redesign my entire compiler tool chain because we decided we're going to change the chip architecture, you know? Instead, all I'm doing is changing my software, and changing my software that I control, my automation, to hit a public API. That's so much easier than what I had to do in the data center, because I can just express it. It's code. I can talk about it. I can collaborate on it. I can do a bunch of stuff. So I don't think it terrifies me all that much. I also think that there's always that conversation around public cloud APIs of wanting to sort of have a universal grand abstraction over them all, you know, like compute is compute is compute or whatever. And I think that's basically false too. They're different because they provide different capabilities. Sometimes they're just different for different sake, but not very often. Like, there's differences between, you know, the infrastructure that you get provisioned at Google and you get provisioned at Amazon, or you get provisioned at Azure. And you might choose one or the other precisely because of those differences. Mm-hmm. You know, and when we build generic abstractions, what we tend to do is lose the ability to express those differences, right? We get the lowest common denominator, which is very rarely what people actually need.
Well, besides generating technical debt as well, you got to maintain this abstraction layer now.
Right. And for what upside, right? You know, there's always this idea that we're going to like migrate our stuff magically from one data center to the other. You can do that, but how many people's applications actually are good at that, or can soak the latency hit, or the list of side effects there is so high that it's unclear where the upside is in doing that. It's super interesting.
Now, as far as the public APIs go, sure, we can roll with the punches. There's a change that's made, but do you, as chef, or do tool makers in general, have some inside scoop as to what's going on? I mean, do you get notified, hey, guys, we're going to make, you know, thus and such a change, and we're going to release the new API version in 6 weeks?
You know, sometimes, but not usually. Usually we learn when you do, pretty much. I think that's getting better. You know, Amazon is starting to realize that having an ecosystem of informed partners and vendors is important in a way that I think they had some justification in saying it was not. That, you know, I don't know how many billions of dollars that business's run rate is, but let's just say it's huge and been growing leaps and bounds. So like their initial position that they didn't want or need or care about partners, I think bore some fruit. you know, but they've changed that now, because when they look at their own growth and they look at the markets they need to go into, I think they're discovering how to partner in a way that they didn't know how to do not that long ago. You know, you can contrast that with like Microsoft. Microsoft's incredibly easy to partner with now. They're super open. They're super collaborative. They'll go really deep with you if you're willing to go deep with them in a way that I think is really great. Google is happy to talk to you and willing to partner, right? I think you're starting to see that change as the public cloud vendors themselves feel more certain in their own offerings and feel more certain in their own boundaries and their own business. It starts to feel safer to have the kinds of really tight collaboration with a vendor that would maybe allow you to know that stuff in advance. Whereas when you're a little less secure, and it's funny to think about AWS as being insecure, but they kind of were, right? Like they were going to grab all the money. The question for them was like, where's the boundary of the money? Like, where's that strategy end? And I have to start partnering to get more money. And like, I think they're right about at the place where they feel like they need to start partnering to get more money. That's fascinating.
So Adam, can you give some examples where the introduction of automation has been successful? And I'm kind of curious, how do you define success in that context?
Sure. So for me, success in automation is always, did it make the lives of the human beings who need to use it better? Yes or no, right? A really good example outside of technology is cars. We, like the Model T required you to like turn a crank, and there's like a 7-step process, and it was really easy to break your arm. Like if it backfired and you were turning the crank with your right hand, you would probably break your arm. That was not so good. It was very simple and super functional, right? Like everybody could understand how that engine worked in a couple of days, but it wasn't better. And you can compare that to like the Audi I drive now, where like I push a button and it starts. And the button says start. It doesn't say ignite. You know, you used to put the key in the ignition, right? Fascinating. Really, that's a very simple example of like automation has been very successful in that space. It's lowered the barrier to entry. It's made the experience easier. I don't break my arm when I start my car. Super good.
Seems important, you know, yeah.
Right? It seems like does seem like a completely rational choice. And I think when you look at technology, a good example, the public cloud infrastructure as a service APIs are a great example of where automation has been successful. You know, there's a ton of automation behind the scenes that makes those instances available, gets the right image booting, you know, connects it to a network, like all of that's fully automated. And I think it's been wildly successful, right? It's driving a huge shift in the way we think about our data centers. I think another is continuous delivery and deployment automation. You know, I think if you look at the ability for us to think about what the workflow is that a team of people goes through in order to get a change into production or delivered to their customers, you know, the impact that our ability to do that quickly and to react very fast has on a company and on their customer impact is so high that that's another example where automation has been, I think, crazy successful, especially when you look at the companies who are so good at it. If you can't deliver whatever the change is that you need to make to the product to your customers effectively in a short period of time, you will likely lose that customer eventually to someone else who can. And I think that's a direct result of our ability to automate, because the existence of that automation gives us the ability to think about that workflow at a high level. Whereas before, without that automation, the idea that you were streamlining the workflow was silly because you had so many blockades to getting your software or your infrastructure change out into production that thinking about the workflow was completely premature, right? Like you could barely influence it because all of the things you needed to change were so arbitrary. There were so many things in your way.
Speed seems like a fairly obvious and perhaps not all that important piece for the automation value add. What I'm thinking is that consistency and repeatability are really clutch, you know, especially across multiple humans. They have different skills, they do things differently. You want to make sure that every time a task is performed, it's done reliably to deliver those services across all of the organization.
As Adam was talking about the public cloud and the increasing importance it is to our infrastructure, the thing that struck me was Amazon, the leader in public cloud infrastructure as a service, is struggling as a partner. And, you know, they realize they need to get better at partnering, but in fact, they're not that good yet with third parties that need tooling. And on the other hand, Microsoft is really good at partnering and will go deep with you if you're a tool maker and are interested in working with that tool on the Microsoft public cloud platform on Azure. It's fascinating to me because it shows you who has a lot to lose, if you will, and who has a lot to gain. And Microsoft as sort of the underdog here, who's been chasing after Amazon for a while now, is getting more and more and more aggressive, not willing to lose market share any further, and finding a new home and a new position for the long run in the infrastructure game.
All right, Adam, automation's awesome. We all love it. We want to get the Matrix goggles, et cetera. But there's an impact on us meatbags that are listening about comfort. What does it actually mean when I start introducing automation, you know, ad hoc or holistically in the environment on hiring people? That seems like a big concern that everybody should be kind of focused on.
It's easiest to think about this as an economic question rather than a technical question. So, you know, if you think about the economics of your industry, and you're thinking about how employable is someone, what are they capable of doing? The first question is, if you have the skills that allow you to operate at a higher level, you tend to be more employable. So if you want a job and you want that job to be long lasting and fulfilling and highly paid, your ability to work at a high level and to be effective is super important. And usually that's what good automation does. If you can get good at either using automated systems or building automated systems, what that tends to lead to is higher paying jobs and more job security, because you become more embedded in the value delivery process of your organization. Does that make sense? So the impact it has on your employability is, if you are in an industry that is rapidly automating, you need to get good at either building that automation or building the systems that rest on top of that automation in order for your skills to stay current. Which I think there's a secondary sort of question that hides behind there, which is about, do people lose their jobs, right?
Well, surely there must be people that lose their jobs. I mean, okay, so let's look at this from a business perspective. You mentioned economics. So if I'm a business owner and I'm looking at trying to wrestle more money out of my IT department that perhaps I've been looking at as a cost sink for a long time, one of the things I could say is, okay, if I could automate a lot of my deployment, I can reduce my ops staff, and then, you know, my developers can bring applications to market faster. And that's good. That's a win. You know, I get a double-sided win, you know, fewer bodies to be paying and benefits and all that, and then more productivity out of my development people.
Yeah, God, that'd be awesome if it was true. It's just false. Look, to use economics again, there's an assumption hiding in there, which is demand exceeding supply? So why precisely is it that you want to automate? So if you're automating really, truly just to destroy heads, there's no external demand driving you forward, then sure, if you were to automate those things, people would lose their jobs. Now, how many people in IT really actually, or in software development, really believe that there's not basically infinite demand for the service you provide, right? Like, you've never, ever heard anyone ever in an organization, small or large, be like, man, you know, it'd be fine. Go ahead and solve my technical problem in 2 weeks, right? That's just not real. So the demand is, in fact, essentially unbounded. Like, we actually don't know where the cap is on demand for IT and for technology. And what that means is, as you get more efficient at delivering that technology, you don't get to decrease your investment. Instead, what you do is get more efficient and you start putting out more, right? So we see this in history with like coal mining. Every time we got an improvement in coal mining, we didn't mine less coal, we mined more coal because their demands continued to rise. The same thing's true here. Like, you automate things, that's awesome. What's going to happen isn't that you stay steady at your rate of deployment. Instead, you're going to deploy twice as often, three times as often, five times as often. So you don't get to reduce staff. All that changes is what your staff is doing. They're managing the automation. They're managing the abstraction. They're managing more deployments. They're managing particular kinds of failure instead of other things. But it doesn't tend to go down. And we have enough history of automation in IT now to say pretty surely that it's just false. And so you tend to see the management question come up all the time, where managers are like, oh, I'm going to be able to get this cost reduction. It's a terrible strategy at the executive level for trying to push automation, because it turns out not to be true. It's also untrue for workers. So if, as a worker, you're worried that automation will eliminate your job, that's false. As long as what you do is move forward with that automation. So where your job gets to be at risk isn't that automation took your gerb, right? It's that the skills required to do your gerb changed, and you didn't move with those skills. Instead, you just folded your arms and were like, I prefer hand cranking my cars. I don't like pushing the start button. Start buttons are for wimps. I already know to turn the crank with my left arm so it never breaks. What's your problem?
It's the same story that's been in IT all along, because IT is in a constant state of change. It's a constant state of technology advancement and new technology that outstrips old technology. We got to retire the old and bring in the new. And how do you maintain your usefulness to a business? You just keep updating your skills. If the latest skill happens to be automation, because that is what the business needs, then you get those skills and then move ahead and you're still employable.
Yeah, and that's happening because demand is infinite. If there wasn't demand for more better IT systems, the market wouldn't be building them. But there is, and that demand is basically infinite. Therefore, it's not a cost reduction. What's starting to become true now, as things like infrastructure of code have become more prevalent, is at the macroeconomic level, you can start to actually tie your improvements at the infrastructure level and at the back end to customer outcomes on the front end, right? Amazon can tell you down to the millisecond how much money latency costs on a web transaction. So for every millisecond of latency added, there's some number, and they know the number, of money they lose because some customer decides not to click a button. Fascinating. And so like they can track that down to that layer, and they think about it in that way.
Wasn't it also true that as you start to work with automation, you start to kind of clear up that, I almost call it like janitorial work, you know, configuring a switch, putting together a server, you know, there's not a lot of value with that. It also frees up the opportunity to start doing more meaningful things, kind of like what you were talking about earlier. I'm not doing that sort of work anymore. I'm not just going to lop off the head of that, we call the meat bag. So I'll continue to use the meat bag term.
Yeah.
I can use that person to do something else, because I feel like there's always a backlog of just a bajillion things
there's
that you could
always
be doing.
Yeah, there's always something else, right? And when you think about the like chores that you need to do, the chores just change. It's not like there's less chores when you automate. It's just your chores are about, now you have to maintain a code base. You have to keep your test suite current. You have, like, there's this huge list of chores. They're just different chores than they were when it was like, well, I better walk the data center and replace a hard drive, right? Like, maybe someone still does that chore, but they're probably not you because it's public cloud, you know? It's not that you have less chores. It's just you have different chores. But the part of your day that isn't just doing chores, because if your whole life was just, like, making your bed and doing the dishes, then that's a sad life. So that work definitely changes. They both change, my point. But the chores don't go away. You're still doing chores. It's just they're different chores.
Okay, so DevOps, a big term here. And let's talk about this from that human perspective. How does automation help integrate developers and operations? You know, we kind of understand that if we do automation of stuff, now it's easier for developers to put applications onto that infrastructure. Okay, but there's still a human aspect here where these two groups of people need to be talking to one another.
Yeah, absolutely. One glorious thing is that software developers understand software. When operations people can start talking to software developers about what's happening operationally for their applications and vice versa, and the place where you collaborate on that is software, the barrier to entry gets way lower for that conversation. Instead of having a conversation with an operations person that isn't about the software, now it is. Now, it happens to be infrastructure software, so it's infrastructure as code, it's Chef, it's whatever. But that conversation happening in code and happening in code review tools in the same place where you would have other development conversations, that is a huge win for helping those teams collaborate. And DevOps isn't about the creation of like a single Uber developer / operations person who is a master of both disciplines. It's about the specialists in both disciplines finding the places where they collaborate and making sure that that is a smooth and streamlined thing. It's less so the creation, like I'm sure those people exist who are great at both things, but they're pretty rare. And in fact, what you want are really high functioning teams of specialists who have great ways to collaborate with each other.
Just the way you phrase that, do you kind of think the term full stack engineer is a misnomer or sort of a unicorn?
I mean, I think I know some full stack engineers. Theo Schlossnagel, who runs Circonis and ran OmniTI. I think he's the Michael Jordan of full stack engineers. No one's better than that guy at understanding, like, down to the very minute details how the systems operate and then running all the way up the stack to particular top level delivery. Do I think that that means that our goal as an industry should be to create people like Theo? I think the answer is no, right? I think Theo is a particular kind of person who has dedicated his life in a very particular way to learning those skills. And I think that's amazing. I think most of us don't find the entire range of all of those disciplines quite as fascinating as he does. You know what I mean? Like most of us specialize because we prefer one place or the other. We like to do one kind of work. And a thing that I think is very real is that it takes happy people to create happy teams. Happy teams create happy products. Happy products have a shot at being good companies. But it sort of goes in that order. And so I'm not sure everybody would like being a full stack engineer, because at some point they're going to get to the part of the stack that just isn't fun for them, at which point that's a bummer. And I'd rather have someone doing that work who loved it, you know?
And when we say go all the way up the stack in the context of full stack engineer, are we talking about development at that point or something else in your mind?
I mean, I would argue it's all software development. So like, I've been a systems engineer my whole career. The idea that I wasn't a software developer is false. It's just the software I was developing was used internally, or it was delivered to my team, or like my customer was different. But I've been writing software my whole life. Am I a systems administrator or a software developer? I'm pretty sure I'm a systems administrator. That's what my title was the whole time. And it's my own self-identity. But I've been writing code the whole time. And I think that's true of most systems administrators. You know, how many of them can write a shell script? The answer is all of them, right? And you can say that that's not programming, but it's not true. It's just you're at a different layer in the stack. When we talk about a full stack engineer, I think we do really mean someone who can go from, yeah, I'm tuning the kernel, or I'm writing a shell script, or I'm building a piece of automation, all the way up to, I helped design the way that this mission critical front end works, or an e-commerce site, or I can write JavaScript. That tends to be what we mean. But really, it just means that you can play at each of those layers, the customer facing UI layer, the very low level.
In IT, I have had to reboot my skill set several times. There was, way back in the beginning, my skills as a Novell engineer, and then people quit running NetWare, and I ramped up on Windows NT and moved people to that. And then it was mail systems I had to know GroupWise back in the day, and then it became Microsoft Exchange. And just the ability to convert between those two platforms was a thing, and those were skills I had to specifically learn so that I could migrate customers from one technology to the other. And then it was networking, and then it was a security, and then it was, and then it was, and then it was. All these different skills that I've had to acquire over time in technology. And what was comforting to me listening to Adam was the reassurance that automation, even though it sounds like the kind of thing that could replace a human being in an IT sense, that's not going to happen, because there's always so much more work to do. And I knew exactly what he was saying when he was talking about, look, if you just throw out all the tedious jobs and automate those things away, it's not like you don't have any work to do. You've got a ton of work to do that you were just never able to get to before. Oh, yeah, I had this endless list of things to do when I was running infrastructure that I never seemed to be able to get to, because I was always too busy doing tedious work, the boring work, you know, provisioning stuff, new VLANs, or standing up some new IP block, or building a VPN tunnel somewhere. Just boring, tedious things that if I could have automated away, it would have freed me up to do the more interesting things that were about the system as a whole and making that system better.
I think we're pretty good at shifting around the bottleneck. And for example, if the CPU is the bottleneck and there's an improved chip, then something else becomes the bottleneck. So with automation, I think it helps clear away the bottleneck that we, quote unquote, meatbags input into the workflow. And shifting that means something else becomes the bottleneck, not that you no longer need meatbags.
Well, Adam, we've talked about what automation's good for. We've gotten, I think, maybe the best encapsulation of exactly what it means to humans if automation is coming into their environment. So now I want to move the conversation to something you said from a platform, a panel you were on, I don't remember where it was, Intel IDF maybe. You made the point that we maybe don't need to automate everything, that that's not appropriate. So let me open up a question this way. I mean, if kicking off some action via an API, let's say that's the easy bit. Well, what's the hard bit then?
When most systems have lots of different failure modes. And the more complex a system gets, not always, but in general, complexity is your friend when complexity returns ease of use. So to use that car example, my car is easier to use, but the ignition mechanism on my car is far more complex than the Model T was, right? But you don't care because it's the easy bit now. So the hard bit is modeling through all of those failure modes and saying, how does the system react when this failure happens? How does it react when this failure happens? What happens when this system has a side effect and it starts to affect this other system? You know, when you think about things like microservices and you see people talk about that model, what comes with it are conversations around things like circuit breakers, right? And back pressure and all of those sorts of things. And those are ways to model around the failure conditions that are inherent in everything you do. And they're inherent in automation. So the easy part of automation is writing the automation. Getting a thing to do what you say can be difficult, but it's usually not insurmountable. Where it gets hard is thinking through all of the ways that that might fail and how the system will react. And in general, the right way to think about that is to fall back on core principles of design, as opposed to sort of getting ever more baroque in dealing with each individual failure case. So that's why you see people who do automation at scale talk about things like idempotency. In math, it means if I have the same function with the same inputs produces the same outputs. So if I say that I want a system to be in a particular state, when that thing tells me it's true, it's in that state. Or convergence, which is, you know, I don't know what necessarily what order or what time things will happen in, but I know that if I apply the same set of idempotent functions over and over and over again on a big enough scale, eventually the system will converge to a known good state. And those are things that are really resilient as patterns in the face of failure. So the hard bit is always failure.
As you're building out these massively scaled systems, is it possible, or I guess, is it realistic beyond theory to start suffering failure at scale as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think failure is the one inherent thing in all of our systems. And it doesn't matter how big it gets or how redundant you are or how much you do, like the system will fail, right? You know, a physical example of that is like in a big enough data center, the odds that something will catch fire in a given year increases to 100%, right? Like something is going to catch on fire. And if it doesn't, that's very weird, right? That's because there's a lot of electricity around and there's a bunch of stuff and eventually something will short and something will catch on fire. And then you look at large scale systems where they are failing all the time. What you tend to want to see in those large scale systems are isolation of those failures. So you look at something like Amazon, and it's easy to think that Amazon never fails. The opposite is true. Amazon's failing constantly. What they've gotten really good at is isolating those failures so that, you know, when you go to the website and you want to buy something, it's not crippling your experience on that critical path. Now, that's because they've designed the system in such a way that as the failures happen, which they are, they're just cutting functionality out. You know, there's moments where something you thought you could do, you can't anymore. And that's precisely because that subsystem is failing and they've removed it, right? So designing at scale is about designing for what the failure models will be. And that's ultimately not about preventing all failures, but instead about talking about what the human impact of a failure would be, right? So you look at an airplane, you know, airplanes have highly redundant systems. And the reason for that is that sometimes they will fail. And sometimes they're so redundant that you can have an airplane stay in service with a failed component, right? Because they don't need to swap it out yet because there's enough redundancy that it can still fly.
Okay, so you're reminding me, by training, I am a programmer. Now, I've never done it in anger, not in real life. Just the way my computer science career went, that isn't what I did. But boy, oh boy, you're reminding me of many semesters of coding in ancient languages like COBOL and RPG-2, where you needed to be able to code for failure. You had to be able to accommodate things like really crappy input coming in from an operator and accommodating that and so on. And that is a computer science principle that still holds true, whether it's something as simple as sanitizing input. You know, why do we still have SQL injection problems, for example? And then being able to accommodate those circumstances that it's not what the program was designed to do. It's not what the program, the code was intended to accommodate. And yet you have to accommodate those unexpected things, which is really hard because unless your brain is able to think of all the crazy things, which you're not going to be able to except by experience and lessons learned hard, your code initially is going to be vulnerable in some way to an input you weren't expecting.
Right. And I think that just needs to be okay for a minute. You know, like there's an evolution there that you go through as a developer and that software goes through in its maturity curve. And like you just need to accept that those things are true and you need to fall back on the principles that can help you get through it. So things like idempotency, immutability, you know, like I could give you a whole list, but like you look at those properties and it's those properties that really set you up to be successful. And where it gets really hard is when you have to enumerate every possible failure condition and then make a special case for each one. And instead you want to have a model for failure and you follow that model and the model is what takes care of you as opposed to a specific implementation choice.
Well, all right. In the context of all this, Adam, is when would you say it's not appropriate to automate a task?
You know, the easiest way to think about it is often when the automation exists around a task that is infrequent or uncommon or has very complex side effects in terms of what it does, then I probably wouldn't automate it. A good example there is I've seen a lot of people really want to build automation around their switching infrastructure, like their layer two physical infrastructure in a data center. And my question for them is, how often do you change layer two in your data center? And the answer is never. And then you're like, okay, so why do you want to automate it? And they're like, well, because then we could change it more often. And I'm like, yep, that's true. How often would you change it if you could? And they're like, well, never, because all the servers are just plugged into it. And you're like, right, so what exactly are you doing, right? People have spent millions, billions probably of dollars trying to automate that problem. For what actual benefit? Like, once the switch is there and you've plugged it in and it's basically working and the gear is connected to it and the VLAN's built, like, do you go back and change the VLAN? You know, like, not really, you know, you really don't. What was the upside in putting all that automation in place in the first place? I suppose you could argue that its value is in getting the switch back if it failed, but that's pretty simple automation. That's like, do you have a backup of the config so you can blow it back on the switch, right? That's not a crazy investment in, you know, software-defined networking. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, there's value in getting the net restore. You hit networking, so I got all excited now because that's like my...
That's your jam.
That's my thing. But I mean, yeah, there's obviously value in getting the network to a known state, a predictable state that you can push traffic across. But there's also value in things like multi-tenancy or security, where as you stand up new container or a workload somewhere, and now it needs to have a certain security profile. And being able to automate that is a big deal. And there's certainly been a lot of activity and action in that space.
Yeah. What I think is super interesting in that space is I have a prediction, which is you're going to start to see those models simplify, because right now they're very generic. Like, I want to apply a security profile to an X where X is anything. And I think what you're going to start to see is a shift back toward thinking about it as types of networks with postures, if that makes sense, right? Because that tends to be what you build. If you look at the abstraction people build up with those systems from the very low level to the very high one, they wind up tending toward this higher abstraction where it's like, well, most of our applications live in a profile that looks roughly like X, you know, and there's some degree of detail there, but it's not quite as much. So like, especially in physical infrastructure, I question whether or not at the networking layer automation makes sense all the time. And then when you start talking about I'm up in the cloud or I'm on a scheduler or whatever, obviously now you do need some automation. Then the question is, how complex should that automation get? And the answer is probably not very, because most likely its posture won't change. It's still kind of an on deployment posture.
And interestingly, most of the automation you see for network underlays are simple. They're building simple layer three data center fabrics where all the interesting and complex things happen at a higher level in an overlay.
Exactly.
Probably back in a soft switch.
Yep. And like, it's an interesting problem. And I think thinking about when it's appropriate to automate, the other one I talked about was complex side effects. So another thing you get to a lot is people saying that they want to build really complicated systems for scheduling and auto scaling, right? Where they're like, oh, I'm going to take in a billion metrics a second, and then I'm going to make really smart decisions about how to react in the face of failure. And that for me is I pull back from that pretty rapidly because, okay, which failures are we talking about? And is that actually the right way to deal with them? You know, like a great example is if you have a tiny website that's not served on a CDN and it's just coming off a single server, and Oprah Winfrey decides to, you know, put up a TV special and talk about your thing, no amount of auto scaling is going to save you from the fact that 99% of the people who are going to look at your website are going to go at the exact same second. Oprah says that thing, they open up their laptop because they were sitting there watching Oprah, and they type it in. And sure, man, there's a long tail that shows up later, but 99% of them are going to show up in the first couple seconds, and they probably won't come back if you fail. So for all of that automation you might have put in, who cares? Because the long pole is actually just knowing that you were going to have an event that was sort of like that. And if you didn't plan for it, you're probably just as screwed as you were if you hadn't. And then there's the second question, which is, especially on things like scheduling and failover, you know, you hear all the time that people are sort of dreaming of the day where they can just build a database in the sky and then have that database sort of magically heal itself in a way that moves it around. And the question for me there is, well, okay, but that's your most important asset, and it's the thing that everything sort of critically relies on. And most of its really gnarly failure conditions involve data loss, right? How much of that do you actually want to automate? And how much of it, if you have those failure conditions, do you really actually want a human being to use their meat brain to reason through those choices?
Classic question in data center failover. Do you really just want to automate entire failover over to another data center? Or do you really, 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 and actually want a bunch of human beings to consider the circumstances that are making you look at this scenario and debate whether or not failing over is right? Because automating that entire failover sounds awesome, and there's products built around it, and you can lease communications lines between facilities and all the rest to make it seem awesome and spend tons and tons of money. And then you've automated it, but you didn't think of all the different situations, because failures are not simple. They're not on or off failures. It's usually a complex failure with lots of permutations and things weighing in on what really happened that requires that human being or group of humans to think about, okay, we're going to do it. We're going to make the cutover, and then doing those things.
Because humans are really good at that, and computers are still really bad at it. You know, like, even if we look at the most advanced artificial intelligence, they're not that advanced, right? And they can't make those decisions. And one thing that's true about infrastructure and like data centers, it's always that one special tuning. It's that one thing that makes your application work. It's that one tweak to Postgres that allows it to go fast enough or whatever it is. And those tunings often have implications in failover scenarios. And how does all that get encoded, and where does it happen? And I would argue 99% of the time, it's actually better to just let a human being do it and then design for failure of those components at a different level and try to make that more graceful. And like data center failover is a great example. Like, I've met one customer in 10 years who has completely adopted, you know, like the VMware technology that would let them shift their whole data center from one place to another sort of automatically. One in 10 years. And like the conversation I was having with them was about whether or not they should run Chef's HA stack, because they wanted, you know, multi-data center failover. And I was like, but you just spent all this money on multi-data center failover. Like, why are you asking me? Just plug it into the magic box, you know, and like let it do the magic box thing. And they were like, well, but what if we don't want it to fail over in the data center? I'm like, well, what's happening to the applications? And they're like, oh, they're all automatically failing over between data centers. I'm like, well, then, Bob, like, I think you've made your choice. You know, like, I think this has happened for you. I don't know that I think it was the greatest choice in the world. But man, you know, they sure made it, and they're spending their money. And like, if you used that hard constraint in the rest of your system's design, you could probably build a functioning system that works that way, right? But you just need to know that that's what you're up to. And for most of us, you know, it's not.
Adam, this has been a great discussion. Thanks for finding time in your schedule to chat with us at Datanauts about automation and maybe when it's not right to do automation, which was very thought-provoking, good stuff. So if people want to follow you, Adam, how can they do that?
Sure. They can find me on Twitter. I'm Adam HJK. That's probably the best way. You can also send me an email. I'm adam@chef.io.
Yep. And Adam's also got a blog, blog.chef.io/author/Adam. I found you there. And you got a GitHub repository too. What you got hiding out in GitHub?
Oh yeah. I mean, you can follow all the things that I have. Most of the software I've written in the last 15 years is probably on GitHub. So there you go.
All right. And that is it, folks, for today's edition of the Datanauts podcast. You can reach me at EC Banks on Twitter. My blog is ethancbanks.com. If you look down and squint carefully through a perf tile, you'll find Chris right under there in the data center floor. Also find him at Chris Wall on Twitter, and his blog is wallnetwork.com. And for more of our Datanauts shows about infrastructure engineering, park your jet black spaceship with the black buttons and the black lights at Milliways. And from the end of the universe, stare deeply into the eyes of packetbushers.net. Held in that welcoming gaze, you'll find the Datanauts talking about automation and orchestration, network design, containers, telemetry, full-stack engineering, storage architecture, hyperconvergence, managing complexity, and so much more. And until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed. Buddy, you still there?
I like the use of meat bags.
Yeah, meat bags is a good word.
You're feeling saucy today, huh? All right.
Saucy meat bags, get it? That's a good one.
Oh, I see what you're thinking.